Pickaxe.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello everybody, it's Billy here from The Review of Death. Hope you're doing well. Just a quick heads up that the last 7 minutes of this week's episode of The Review of Death, a Doctor Who podcast, suffers from a quite obvious change in audio. Basically what happened was the microphones that we usually record out of stopped recording, and we've had to take the audio from the cameras that were recording us in the room to kind of finish off the whole thing. It's not that bad. It's noticeable, but it's not that bad. But we just wanted to let you all know before the episode begins. Enjoy!
Hello, and welcome back to The Review of Death, your fortnightly Doctor Who podcast, where we talk about everything that's been happening in the world of Doctor Who in the past fortnight, as well as reviewing a particular story, whether it's from the classic series, the new series, or if the program's on the air...
The new series.
Wow.
And the episodes that we're reviewing are generally considered to not be brilliant. I mean, we've taken them from the bottom of the 2014 Doctor Who magazine poll.
That's right.
Which ranked every TV story up to that point. So I think it goes right up until Time of the Doctor.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, as we've done this for a little while on YouTube, as some people know, and we've reviewed most of the last...
We've done all of Capaldi and Whittaker,
so far.
We don't need to go over that quite yet. So.
No, it leads us into talking about stories like The Twin Dilemma, which we're going to do today.
Yes, more on that later. But have we got any news? Anything happened in the last fortnight?
Well, our podcast launched.
It did.
So thank you all so much for the response to that.
Thank you very much.
Nuts.
It was incredible.
Yeah, it was crazy. And I can't stop refreshing the charts
yes,
to see where we've
where
come.
Where we've gone, yeah.
I don't know what that means, but I know that we were big in Israel for about 3 days.
Oh, massive in Israeli fans.
I know. Tel Aviv is popping.
It's because they've got all of the missing episodes over there. And they're just
hiding in a vault and they're
sitting on Marco Polo.
Let's do a deal. Get us the top of TV and film in Israel, and then you know you can send us a couple of reels to have a look at, and we'll do an exclusive review of Web of Fear episode 3.
We could just play. I was going to say we could just play snippets of it, but then being an audio based podcast, that wouldn't help because we have all the soundtracks. We'd have to play it. We'd have to project it over there.
That would be the rub.
Yeah.
It's like we've got the episodes, but you're just going to hear the film reels that we've got.
This is just the soundtracks. We've had these for years.
Thank you so much for
yes,
that.
Thank you.
It was crazy. And we've got like merchandise available now. If you guys want to have a look at our Represent store, there's links for that in the description down below. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all that good stuff. But news, yeah. So, I mean... The first Doctor monsters, we can talk about that, the action figures, the Sensorites and the Vords.
They're not out yet, still.
They're not out in stores yet?
Not yet, no. There's been a delay of... I don't really know the ins and outs of it.
Oh.
But I saw... This isn't from any official source. This just comes from some Facebook group that said, I think the guy works at B&M, and I think there's just been some sort of delay getting the lorries in
right.
with the toys.
Okay.
I don't know. It's all a bit weird. I don't know.
Blame Brexit.
Yeah, why not? Or the Suez Canal business.
We've come a long way. But, I mean, yeah, you love them.
Oh, yeah, my God. You know, plug for my reviews on this channel.
Oh, yeah, of course, obviously.
Yeah, they're brilliant. Go check them out. Well, I say go check them out. They're not in the shops yet. But
when they won't be around for long.
No,
but, you know.
No, they sell out quick, I'm sure.
New Ninth Doctor set.
Yep, I've started listening to that.
Respond to All Calls. I haven't started it. I haven't downloaded it yet.
It's good. I'm enjoying it more so than Ravagers.
Mm-hmm.
I say more so, a lot more so.
A lot more so.
It's more... I mean, I've only listened to the first one.
Mm.
and it just felt far more sort of based in reality, kind of like a lot of Russell T Davies stuff. It felt very much of that era.
Okay.
You know, very domestic.
Kitchen sink sort of thing.
Very kitchen sink drama, domestic, oh, okay. Police, family, troubles. It, yeah, really, really good. Nice little story.
I didn't know anything about the story behind it. Yeah, so I mean, I'm glad I heard
and
that.
And isn't like... It's not like Ravagers, where it was like, this is all one big story. Mm. It is three separate stories, which I much prefer. I think that works better.
And there's no through line, or are they...
Not that I've seen yet, but I've only listened to the first one. So.
And of course, we've got the Cybermen.
We've got the Cybermen in the next one.
What did you think of the new design?
I think they look great. Mm. I really, really like them, because they've got the proper old school bodysuits and stuff and the chest pieces.
It's a nice, like, fusion of... Yeah. Of classic to new,
yeah,
but it's got enough of a classic throwback that, you know, sad gits like us are wetting ourselves
yeah,
over them,
yeah, yeah,
which is really nice. There was a new press photo of 13 Yaz and Dan.
Oh, yeah, the graffiti one. Yeah,
which
yeah,
looked
yeah,
quite nice.
Yeah, and it just makes you think here against this wall.
Against this wall, it just makes you think. God, like. Can we just have that a little bit more often?
I know. It
was just little things.
And it came out of nowhere, didn't it?
I know.
It was just like, oh, here they are.
And it was
like,
a nice surprise.
It was a nice surprise.
But, like, should we be surprised by, like, things like that? Zero context as to what's going on. It's just them in character.
Yeah.
In costume.
But, of course, this is all part of some wider media thing about find the Doctor.
So,
hashtag.
I don't know anything about this.
Neither do I. I just saw it blow up suddenly on social media, on Twitter, and I was just like, oh, okay. There's not been like a press release saying, oh, this thing is happening. It's just randomly people are like, oh, have you seen these reviews on Google? The Doctor's trying to tell us something. It's like, what?
I think it's kind of the most interesting thing in a long time.
Yeah.
Like, just in, not, you know, not just in terms of the marketing for the show, but just the show in general. It's like, whoa, like, somebody's thinking about all of this, you know, and I'm not saying that the people that work on it don't think about cool things, and you know, some are probably rebuffed and some don't happen or whatever, but it's really interesting. I'm enjoying watching people who are more you know, have got more time on their hands than me, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. It's not, I mean, obviously we're also not really based in the right place, because I think it is all Sheffield based, a lot of it, I think. I think so. There was something at a museum, and I think that was up north.
And there was...
They had the sonic screwdriver in a glass case.
No.
And it was, and it was done like, oh, this is made from Sheffield steel, but, you know, we don't
Origin
know what
unknown
it is.
Origin unknown or whatever.
That's really cool.
I saw the Google reviews for the flats.
Yes.
And the photo was of the TARDIS on Google Street View or something.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah.
I really like it. And I'm going to enjoy watching everybody else do the hard work.
Yes.
And then I'll enjoy, you know, it afterwards. A bit like Time Lord Victorious, I suppose.
Yeah.
I got an email today from Doctor Who Worlds Apart, or whatever it's called.
Oh, yeah.
That NFT trading card thing.
Oh, God, the bloody digital...
They're just like, they've now just gone... Get your Time Lord Victorious frames or whatever around the cards. It's a bit late, guys.
That is very late.
I want to know, has anybody... If you're watching... My God, could you imagine... like 4,000 to 5,000 people watched the first one?
Yeah.
Is there one person out of that group that will admit to having...
Played that game.
Played that game.
And
or,
paid money to get a card.
Invested in these digital cards. I don't know the first thing about NFTs and all that kind of stuff.
No, me neither.
But I'd be really interested to see if any... But no judgment, you know, if you've done it maybe it's
like
a solid
scam.
It feels like a scam. But maybe that's because we don't know anything about it. But it probably is a scam. The Web of Fear reconstruction came out.
I was thinking the Web Planet then. I was like, "What? Why have they reconstructed that?" Yes, Web of Fear. I've not watched it. I don't own it. I didn't buy it. I this feels really mean, because it feels like I'm kicking a man while it's down, because, you know, they just it just didn't look very good.
No.
It just didn't look very good. And
I think it's so difficult doing that kind of 3D animation.
Yeah. And
in that art style.
Yes.
I think we might have said this last week.
And there was a thing on Facebook. Did you see the documentary clip on Facebook? And I feel mean saying this, but it was like something out of a screen wipe. Or
really?
Like a Philomena Kunk.
Really?
Because the guy, the director, I don't know who he is. And obviously, you know, fair play to them for doing this stuff.
Thank you, but...
But... he was talking about, oh, you know, it was all motion capture to try and get the actions and the movements as realistic as possible.
And then it cut to the footage
and they were there like Gerry Anderson puppets moving around.
And I was like, oh no,
this is beyond parody, surely.
No.
And I mean, I feel horrible. And I, you know, they turn around and they say stuff like, oh, you know, this could be an avenue that we go down to animate stories that we've been told are sort of unanimatable on the budget that we currently have.
Because we've been told, everybody's heard, The Crusade is really difficult to do because of the costume changes, same with Marco Polo and blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. So they sort of said, you know, if we just have a person as a rig and we can just swap the skins, I guess, then that makes things a hell of a lot easier. And yeah, that's fine, I guess. But I just think if you're going to do a 7-part epic like Marco Polo, or even a smaller one like The Mythmakers.
And how long have people waited for stories like that? And then you have to watch that.
Yeah, you know, there needs to be more money. If this was just the prototype, if this was just like, okay, let's see how we go on a very small budget. And then for a proper release, we'll do, 4 episodes, but we'll put more money into it and polish it up.
Do you know what?
That'd be fine.
I think The Web of Fear is probably the perfect episode to do that with if it is a prototype, because it's still so fresh, the excitement of seeing it and having it on physical media. And there's only one episode missing from it.
Yeah.
And I don't mind watching the Telesnap reconstruction for it.
No.
I mean, God, I sat through the Telesnap reconstruction of bloody Faceless Ones when we reviewed that.
You know.
And that was fine.
Yeah.
So I think I can do one episode of Telesnaps for The Web of Fear. But I think the reaction to it has been so overwhelmingly negative.
Yeah.
I can't really speak. I've seen clips. We've all seen the clips. We know roughly what it looks like. But I can't really comment on it fully because I haven't seen the whole thing. But I think the reaction to it has been so negative that if they did say, we're going to do Dalek's Master Plan like this, I think people would just have a fit.
I think don't bother.
There'd be a proper actual boycott of it. Because I've seen people saying, you know, don't support this stuff because if you buy it, they'll think people want this.
Yes, exactly.
And I get that argument.
Yeah.
So, but then again, at the same time, you don't want to sound like a dick because there's a lot of work that
people
have put into this.
I mean, you know, I didn't buy it because I saw the animation and thought, oh, this doesn't look great. I didn't buy it just because I thought, well, I've bought this story already.
Yeah.
I can live without seeing the reconstruction.
God, what a sap I am for buying that remastered Power of the Daleks. I feel like such an idiot now you said
thought,
that.
Oh, well, season 5 of the collection will come out at some point. I'll just, it'll be on there.
Exactly.
And to be honest, by that point, they might have even tweaked it and zhuzhed it up.
Mm.
It'll be the, well, that'd be the second special edition version of that story.
Anyway, talking of the collection sets, anything you want to ask me, Matthew?
Oh, yeah. What was it like filming some of the VAM for one of the sets?
Yeah, it was fantastic. Life-changing moment. I'm above all of this now, so, you know, this might be the last episode. I'll just go off and spend a weekend with Chris Chapman every week filming.
What is Toby Haydock's sandwich order?
It's prawn mayonnaise.
Oh!
Did you think that I was going to say that?
I didn't think you were going to say that. I thought you were just going to laugh, but okay.
No, it's prawn mayonnaise, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So I was running on it.
Yeah.
And I haven't been a runner for 5 years. I'm not saying that to sort of go like, I'm above all this, but, you know, I haven't done it for a long time and it was a bit knackering, but brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was fantastic. So look forward to that coming out whenever it comes out on whatever set it comes out on.
Of course, you can't say anything.
As soon as I posted the photo or like said, oh, I did it.
Everyone's
in my DMs going like, oh, you know, oh, that's great. That sounds fantastic. And then trying to just like sneakily just sandwich it. Compliment. What is it? Compliment. And I'm like, oh, cheers. Thanks. Yeah, it was good fun. I can't say, but it was great. It was really cool. So
it was the series 1 set. He was with Christopher Eccleston and Billy Piper.
We were talking about Flaming Sofa, which was people who know that reference know that reference. So today we're going to talk about the Twin Dilemma. That is as excited as I will get for this story.
Don't make me, please.
Let
me get my notes out.
Yeah, we've both watched the Twin Dilemma as voted for by you lovely people, or should we even be nice to them and call them lovely people?
I don't know if we can thank these people for this.
Now, The only other Colin related thing we've reviewed in the past, besides Dimensions in Time, obviously,
is the
Trial of a Time Lord, which we did at
Phantom.
A Phantom event,
yeah.
Pandorica.
That's right.
In Bristol, which was great. And I really, really liked going back and watching that.
Same.
Because it was
like that story.
It's fun.
It's all right.
It actually has a bit of a bounce to it, and it feels like they've hit a bit of a rhythm. And Colin's obviously fantastic, but there is a real kind of melancholy I feel watching it, because as you get further and further towards the end, you think, I've only got another like 25 minutes left with this Doctor, and then he disappears, and that's really sad.
And it's so unceremonious as well.
You know, I know.
There's no grand build-up like to any other Doctor leaving. It is just
carrot juice.
That's it, and he's just gone.
And then he whacks his head on the side of the console, falling off an exercise bike, and becomes Sylvester McCoy.
Hey!
So, yeah, I mean, I really like the Sixth Doctor.
Same. Love him.
I love Colin.
Yeah.
And I will say from the outset, Colin Baker's the best thing in this.
Yes, definitely.
By a long way.
That is my third or fourth point,
Yeah.
Steals every scene
he's in. And this is, you know, it's very difficult talking about this story because it is so disliked.
Yes.
And I know that that period was difficult for the people working on it.
Yeah.
And I know that even fans talking about it in a sort of throwaway manner can dredge up negative feelings about working on the show at that time. And I completely understand that. And this is not a place to be dredging up bad vibes.
No, of course.
So this is no reflection on any individual who worked on it. Certainly not Colin. Certainly not Nicola.
No.
But The Twin Dilemma is the worst episode of Doctor Who ever made.
Do you really think so?
I think it is.
Really? Gosh.
Mainly because, and we'll get onto it a little bit later, but the things it does introduce where you think, oh, seconds later it fucks it up. It's such a shame.
That's
my one
saying.
Swear out of the way.
I get you what you're saying, yes.
And it's so disappointing. And because I was watching it last night, and thank God I took a break between parts 2 and 3, because I needed to just kind of like step away from it and go, oh, I'm getting so irritated watching
this story.
Because everything it does wrong, I think I mean, that's not totally fair. I think, well, we'll get into it. But I mean, what are your general...
So, I mean, I went into it thinking to myself, all right, obviously we all know the connotations this story has within fandom of being utter crap, you know. It has been voted the worst Doctor Who story for years. And I thought, you know, I'm not gonna go in with that mindset. You know, if ever I do a marathon or whatever, it's always a story that I sort of put on and I switch off and do anything else.
You have to get through it.
Yeah.
Lie back and think of Caves of Androzani.
Exactly. But I thought, no, I'm going to put all that out of my head. I'm going to try and watch it fresh, as if I was watching it for the first time in 1982 or whatever year it is, 83.
I think you're making it harder for yourself in that headspace.
And the thing is, the trouble with this story is that it comes after Caves of Androzani, which is, of course, one of the best Doctor Who's for various reasons, just as a script, as a production. It just looks very fresh and very new. Graham Harper is a very new up-and-coming director. He does lots of things that haven't been done before in Doctor Who at that point. It just feels very different from anything that comes before that story, and then certainly that comes afterwards. So you have that sort of tour de force story, and then you cut back to The Twin Dilemma, which is just the direction is... I didn't look up who directed it.
Well, that was one of my notes, actually, but go on.
The direction is flat as a pancake. There is nothing particularly interesting done. It's just, yeah, cut to this, cut to that, cut to this wide, cut to this. And of course, that is the way television was made. But when you have just come off of Caves of Androzani, where you've got Graham Harper like bringing the camera in really close and doing lots of interesting angles and stuff, and you know, he's directing from the floor, unheard of in television at that point. You know, everyone's up in the gallery, not him. The dynamism of that story, you really want it for this one as well, because you know, you're introducing a new Doctor, you're really trying to sell this character you know, before we even get into the what they do with the Doctor's character in this story,
because there's a lot to
unpack there. And then it's just like, it looks awful. Just as a production, there are very few things, I feel terrible saying this, but there are very few things that look good about it. Obviously, Colin's costume, well, we all know, everyone hates Colin's costume. Colin hated his costume. I don't mind it. It's grown on me over the years.
Yeah.
I think the problem with it is that you've got him in that outfit, then Perry comes out equally weird, not particularly pleasant outfit.
And then Lang.
And then they're bloody Lang, yeah. He's like, my costume's been destroyed. I have a massive wardrobe here. I wonder what I should choose.
Maybe
a jacket, maybe a jumper. Oh no, I'll go for the sparkly sequined multicolored monstrosity.
It's like some 90s shell suit.
It's ridiculous. The worst.
But the thing I think is actually interesting about that, and I'm just thinking of this on the fly, maybe they dress them, Nicola and is it Kevin McNally in that story?
Yeah.
That badly to draw attention away from Colin.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, Lieutenant Lang looks
he is the worst dressed in the story. Yeah.
Than Colin.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the epitome of bad taste. Colin looks pretty normal. Which is, I don't think anyone has ever said this.
But I think that's because it's the silhouette of Colin. Looks great.
Yeah.
It's just the colour of it.
Yeah.
It's kind of like an Edwardian showman
sort of
thing. And that really suits him.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's nothing wrong with the cut of it.
No.
There's nothing wrong with the type of frock coat he's wearing or the waistcoat or the cravat.
No.
It's just the colour of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love seeing those edits where people will put, recolour it.
Or even
the blue one.
Yeah, the
which
Big
we obviously
one.
Got with Big Finish and Real Time and so on. Yeah. Now, interesting you mentioned the direction.
Yeah.
It was directed by Peter Moffat.
Peter Moffat, of course it was, yes.
Who's just come off of The Five Doctors.
Yeah.
The year before.
Yeah.
And so what's happened? I mean, they all admit the script's rubbish. And you can't do it if the material is crap.
Yeah.
You know, like, you had, you know, Bob Holmes writing The Caves of Androzani.
Yeah.
That script is obviously dynamite.
Yeah.
And that will help infer the director. And like you say, Graham Harper is a great director within his own right. I'm not saying that Peter Moffat
I like Peter Moffat's stories generally. Like you said, Five Doctors, State of Decay. I love State of Decay.
That is a really good-looking story,
and it looks
isn't
great.
It? Yeah.
And I think this is the thing. I think the sets don't look particularly
it's awful.
Exciting.
I think I wrote that the design is just
like
horrendous.
The house,
story.
The kid's house is just... it's just appalling. I feel terrible. We're using some horrible words.
Well, look, let's start from scratch. Okay, so we've got the idea. We're not going to be praising this story, but we've got some details. Let's go through it kind of chronologically. As I like to do, I've done this for live events before, but I thought I'd give a bit of kind of pop culture context as to what's going on at the time. Just to kind of, you know, if this is what Doctor Who looks like, what does everything else look like at the time? Because that's, you know, it's interesting to see what's going on in the public consciousness. Do you want to guess what the number one single was in the UK? March 1984?
Oh, I don't know. Kim a Chameleon.
Hello by Lionel Richie.
Oh, really?
So we're not, you know, in the depths of despair when it comes to culture at the time. UK number one box office. Oh, we are now, actually. Yeah. Terms of Endearment with Shirley MacLaine and Jack Nicholson.
Right.
And a movie called Yentl, which was produced, written, directed, and starring Barbra Streisand.
Yeah.
Ghostbusters would become the biggest film of the year, grossing in the UK. That was released in December.
Right.
And This Is Spinal Tap had just come out in the States as well.
Right.
So, you know, it's not a bad year for stuff.
No.
When I was...
Just Doctor Who.
I know. I've done a little bit of research for the next episode for Underworld. And there's, you know, a big thing that's happened around that time, which is pretty massive.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of culturally.
Yeah.
But
is it the biggest indie film that was ever made?
Yeah, I think it's something like that.
Yeah.
A shite hope, something like that. Yeah. No hope at all. But yeah, it's... there's nothing else going on. There's nothing. Star Wars came out at the perfect... I'll ruin it. Star Wars, obviously,
yeah.
That came out just before Underworld came out.
Nothing. God, that's such bad timing.
I know, isn't it? Isn't it the worst? Also, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy text adventure had just been released by Infocom around the time that this came out. And Miss Pac-Man won console video game of the year.
Oh.
In terms of notable events around this time, this is just to paint... this is the world that the people are living in when this story comes on television.
I think this is what the collection sets do well, is when you have all those news items and stuff, it really does give you a flavour of what stuff was like. And one thing that I lament is on the season 12 box set, you had that wonderful documentary, which was all about television.
Right.
What was going on in television and in the world at that time. And then they said, oh, we can't do them anymore because something to do with the rights issues with clips and stuff.
I guess it's rights, yeah.
And it's like, oh, that was such a shame. I loved that. It was really interesting to see. Because, you know, as Doctor Who fans, we just see all this stuff in like a little microcosm of its own. It's just like, this is a crap story from the 80s. But it's interesting to see, oh, okay, what was going on?
Well, it's not a very happy time, I have to say. So just prior to the transmission of The Twin Dilemma, British coal miners start striking against coal mines being shut down. So that's obviously in the public consciousness and everyone's feeling pretty crap about that. So that strike began on the 6th of March.
Yeah.
And this is the 22nd of March.
Okay.
So that's really raw and obviously will continue for a long time.
My God, The Twin Dilemma was broadcast over my birthday.
Was it?
Yeah, if I had been born in 1983.
Truly cursed. A week later, Gerry Adams is shot.
Right.
Sinn Féin leader. So it's all kicking off.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a particularly happy time. 2 days later, CIA station chief William Francis Buckley, based in Beirut, is kidnapped by Hezbollah and dies in captivity. And on the day part
Did
one...
Did they show him to a dilemma? I'm so sorry I should have said that, but it was just a bit of a hex.
I think there is a bit of a hex because on the day part one was broadcast, seven people were charged with satanic ritual abuse at a preschool in California.
Oh my God.
So I think there is a bit of a hex on this story, to say the least. So that's what people were waking up to the morning that The Twin Dilemma came out. Also, we should say this is the last story to be broadcast twice weekly.
Yes.
Starting with Castrovalva, Doctor Who was it always Thursdays and Fridays, or was it Mondays and Tuesdays to start with?
Pass.
I have a feeling there was like, I don't know.
Yeah,
it
was something like that, wasn't it?
But so part one, Thursday, part two, Friday, and then you wait for part three the next Thursday and part four the next Friday. Now, watching this story, it's really interesting you were mentioning, you know, how much of a breath of fresh air that Caves of Androzani seems. Doesn't this feel like a really crap 70s story? Just the pacing of it.
Yeah, it feels like we've gone back in time.
I'm expecting Nick Courtney to walk through the door and go, now, Doctor, what's all this
business
about?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
so, like, I'm not saying those stories are flat or bad or anything from the 70s. One of my favourite eras in the show. But
I think when you've just come off of the back of something like, you've had Resurrection of the Daleks, which is, like, massively good.
Yeah.
You've been, okay, you've got Planet of Fire, which is poo, but it looks nice because they've shot it in Lanzarote, so it looks like there's a bit of money in it, and you've got someone like Peter Wingard in it, so it's like a big guest star.
Sure.
And then you have Caves, and then you have this, and this is the season finale.
I know.
You know, which is
Caves part four was last Friday.
Yeah. Like, you know, it's unheard of to introduce your Doctor at the end of the season.
Mm.
I mean, obviously, I know Pat Troughton comes into season four.
Yes. That's the only other time.
That's the only other time. But he has a few stories.
Oh, I suppose if Christmas Invasion counts as part of series one's production block, that might count as well.
Obviously, the benefit of that was that it wasn't a pile of crap.
That's true. Christmas Invasion is brilliant.
We really enjoyed watching that. Yeah.
Do you want to guess what this story got in terms of viewing figures? So this is 1984, new Doctor, so that might be a bit of a ratings bump, obviously coming off of a creative high with Caves.
I'm gonna be generous, and I'm going to say 7 million.
7.4
wow.
for part one, dropping to 6.3 for part four. Not a crazy drop-off.
No, not at all.
But you've lost 1.3 million across that time. And the drop-off between part three and four was really bad. 700,000 people dropped out between part three and part four.
Yeah.
Now, in this context of telly these days, that's like a death nail.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, to get 700,000 on a show is, you know, not great, but, you know, that's like kind of average Channel 5 viewing figures, something like that, Channel 4 sometimes. But, like, that's a really quite significant drop-off.
For primetime BBC.
For primetime BBC in a day's difference between part three and
my
four.
Gosh.
That's 700,000 people that have gone...
Not watching this.
Not watching the rest of this. I've wasted my time. And it took you to part three to realise
that. I mean,
that.
To be fair, you know, they tried.
Yeah. I mean, right, let's get into
it. Good on them.
Good on them. Let's get into it. The only kind of real highlight for me watching it this time was Dennis Chinnery's in it. Garmin from Genesis.
Yes, he is. The Daleks.
Says he's the dad. Apparently, he was a late replacement for somebody who couldn't do it.
Right.
But he walked in and heard his voice.
Went,
it's Dennis Chinnery. Fantastic. So that was a nice little lift. But then Romulus and Remus are also there in that scene. And do you want to hear the way that they're described in the script?
Go on, then.
Any idea kind of what they might be fishing for, what they might be looking for? If you were to describe these two 14-year-old boys who are, you know, just hanging around the house together, not doing anything in particular, how might you describe them?
I don't know.
Would you describe them as 14-year-old twin children?
Yeah, yeah.
Dark.
Okay. No.
Extremely good-looking.
I was going to say, is it going to be because of the whole Greek
almost
sexually
thing. So.
Oh, who wrote this story?
Gary Downey, apparently. Yeah, I mean, my God, this
wow.
that what a great way to start things off when you're watching.
Can you imagine that the casting? You know, just
those 14-year-olds aren't sexy enough for this story. Do you know what I mean, though? Who wrote that?
Jesus.
I don't think. I mean, Anthony Stephen wrote the story. He made up some crazy things to try and excuse the fact that the story wasn't coming in on time. One of his most famous excuses was his typewriter exploded. It probably got bloody confiscated by CID for what he was writing.
I'm not surprised if it spontaneously combusted. It probably just thought, this is shit, you're writing on me, I'm out of here.
Horrendous. Anyway, so we talk about Romulus and Remus.
I mean, they're fine.
I don't think they're as bad as people make them out to be. They're child actors.
This is the thing. I was watching it and I was thinking, you know, They're not actors, really. You know, there's one moment where I thought, actually, that's not too bad, which was in episode 2, when it's just the two of them, and they're like, oh, I'm scared, Romulus, blah, 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 blah. And I thought, that's actually quite a nice moment. You know, that's actually some proper drama going on here.
I did
not
write
just
on
plot.
That line. I went, tell your face. Because, yeah, like, I mean, that's the problem.
It doesn't reach their faces. And obviously, neither of them.
No.
You know?
And it doesn't help that they're identical twins. No. So you cut to one for a reaction shot thinking, this might be slightly better. And it's like, it's exactly the same face.
You might as well just put a mirror up to one person.
Literally.
But, you know, I was thinking about it and I was like, well, you know, child actors are hit or miss in anything. Harry Potter is obviously a big one. In terms of Doctor Who, those two kids from like Nightmare and Silver, universally loathed by all, you know, at least they're not, you know, at least Romulus and Remus are just shit actors. They're not like irritating characters, you know?
Well, this is actually a point I wanted to make, because I think the main thing we probably need to talk about at the start is Colin's character as the Sixth Doctor.
Yeah, that's the big one, isn't
it? Because it really did put me in the same mindset, not quite to the same degree in terms of what he does physically, obviously, to Perry.
Yeah.
But the way that the 12th Doctor was originally written as this really unpleasant person to be around, and there's nothing redeeming about him.
No.
And there's absolutely nothing redeeming about the Sixth Doctor in this story until that last scene.
Yes.
Which I will come back to later. But like, he is just unbearable to watch, this character.
Yes.
It's no reflection, because Colin's doing what's written down the page. Yeah. And what he is doing, he's committing to it.
Yeah.
And he's doing it very well and doing it in a very committed manner. But it's not pleasant to watch.
No.
At all.
I think it's quite funny because you see him, his first scene where he's, you know, looking at himself in the mirror and all that stuff, he's brilliant.
All that stuff's really nice.
Yeah. And then, you know, you have the moment in the TARDIS wardrobe where he has his first fit. And initially, like, when I was watching it, I was like, you know, this is actually a really cool idea. This is, you know, they've obviously thought, right, you know, we've done this 5 times now. What can we do to make it more interesting? And I think the idea of the Doctor's regeneration going wrong in a different way, obviously Cast Revolver is it goes a bit wrong, but, you know, for it to feel like some sort of trauma, I think that's quite a cool idea. Unfortunately,
absolutely,
it's just the way they go with it. And I think I was sort of thinking to myself, like, oh, they could have done something really interesting, like, you know, unfortunately, again, it would have been a bit too Cast Revolver-y, but could they have taken the Doctor somewhere to recuperate? Could he have gone to, like, some sort of an asylum or something? And, you know, the story could be something like, oh, there's something going on that the Doctor knows, and he's trying to warn people, but they're like, no, he's just mad. And then, like, you know, by episode 4,
I suppose that's the problem, though, is that you want to see the new Doctor as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And I feel like we only really see Colin as the Doctor that we know now, even through Big Finish or through later kind of TV stories or whatever. Yeah. When there's, I mentioned it in my notes, there's a scene near, I think it's in part three or part four, where they look at the gastropod eggs.
Yes.
And he uses the laser scalpel or whatever it is to have a look at it. And the way he's talking about it and the way he's talking about the kind of imminent peril that they're all in is really great.
Yeah.
And so when you take the Sixth Doctor out of that hyper craziness and the post-traumatic or post-regeneration kind of trauma and stuff, he, you know, it's just lovely seeing him be doctory and doing Colin's great at exposition.
Yeah.
He's really, really good at all the techno babble.
Yeah.
Probably one of the better doctors at just reaming off, you know, reeling off all this techno babble
stuff.
You
believe it, don't you?
He's utterly committed to it, and he really is the best thing in this. And Nicola Bryant's great as well, but
I think he feels like, you know, the voice and stuff, he feels like he is a learned individual, you know. He feels professorial in that way. He feels like some sort of a teacher.
That does get on my nerves a little bit, though.
Oh, really?
It's all the 17th and 18th century literature that he's quoting through it. It's like nothing interests six-year-olds or gets them on side more than quoting whatever Longhorn or whatever he calls
him. Oh, yeah. It's all that stuff, isn't it? When he's coming out of the TARDIS and he's all, bloody hell.
I had to check Pip and Jane Baker didn't write this, because they write a lot of that sort of stuff into their stories.
Very much so.
All the kind of mottos and catchphrases that he doesn't quite get right.
Yes.
He does a couple of those in this story, and I thought, God, Pip and Jane must have been taking notes. Like, this is, it's not far away from what they would end up doing with him.
Yeah.
You know, I was kind of shocked when I looked at the thing again and went, well, this is a Pip and Jane story, isn't it? And mainly because Anthony Stephen, what's he ever done before?
Yeah.
And never worked on the show again.
No.
That was something else I picked up on, actually, was that he'd never actually written anything original for telly, Anthony Stephen. He was very good at adapting stories, because Eric Saywood is talking to him and saying, look, this doesn't work, this doesn't work, blah, blah, blah. Sending notes back, all that kind of stuff. I mean, Eric Saywood apparently rewrote a large portion of this. Mm. Does it come across as a better story? Are there things you notice in it that are particularly Saywood-y?
No, not really.
I don't think he rescues the script.
No, but I don't think
that's a particularly great look on him, that he can't lift it, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, we already know that behind the scenes, you know, he wasn't particularly enamoured with Colin's casting.
Yes, that's the whole thing as well.
You know, I don't think he was particularly keen on the idea of the Doctor being unpleasant and unlikable.
Which is quite right, because it doesn't come across well at all.
It doesn't work. And when I was watching it, I was thinking this was just, it was a cool idea, maybe for part one, but for the whole story,
it becomes
no way.
No, and I got it as well when we were watching Trial of a Time Lord.
Yeah.
In Mind Warp, when he kind of gets his head fried.
Yeah.
And he's playing for the other side, I was like, I thought we've got over this.
Yeah.
And it makes it so unbearable to watch. Yeah. It's not nice. It's not good viewing when the Doctor's being horrible.
Yeah.
Or when the Doctor is, you know that I've got to sit through 3 25-minute episodes of this now.
Yeah.
And he's just going to be like this the whole time. And then it gets to like part three and part four, and he's still being all cowardly and going, oh, no, take her.
It's awful.
It's so awful to watch.
Is it any wonder that it lost those viewers? Because I can completely understand why people would be like, crikey, if this is what it's going to be like, no, not for me. Thank you very much. Bye. I can understand it.
Mm. It's such a shame as well, because again, like, it's not like Colin's embodying that character, and he's only playing that character.
Yeah.
And, you know, the stuff he wanted to do with it that he never got the opportunity to do, because he's being weighed down by this awful script. And again, like you say, flat direction.
Yeah.
And it does just, it conspires to just make this a really painful watch. And it's painful in hindsight, knowing how little time he had on the show.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're ruining it by giving him this story. Yeah. This screen time is being given away to this script.
Yeah.
And he's so great.
Yeah.
And it's a real, real shame.
And it's mad to think, you know, that when we flash forward to Deep Breath, obviously the 12th Doctor is nowhere near as bad as the 6th Doctor in that respect, but it does make you wonder, you know, what were they thinking? Did they not learn from what happened in 1983 or whatever year it was?
I think Stephen Moffat had probably stopped watching the show at that point. He was probably rejecting the idea of Doctor Who as a whole, because it, you know, he never talks very fondly about the 80s
no, not at all.
Era of the show.
No.
I mean, does he ever talk fondly about the programme when he's not writing it? I don't know. anyway, so and the other thing we need to talk about, we've kind of skirted around it, but it's the physical assaulting of Perry.
Yeah.
And not just in that first part. I've got some behind the scenes stuff as well, which we probably want to talk about.
Right.
but I mean, what do you make of it all? Because it is, it's...
I mean, it's a shocking moment.
Yeah.
I don't dislike it, I got to say. And I actually think it's probably the most interestingly directed bit of the whole story with the mirror. And I think that's what annoys me. I was thinking, watching it, is like, if you had someone like Graham Harper directing this story, just the stuff like when he collapses into the wardrobe, into all the clothes, and he has that little moment where he's like, oh, the grinding engines of eternity, whatever that was. You think, oh God, he would have brought the camera in really close and it would have gone all squiffy. He'd have done some really interesting stuff with it. And
you could have seen the regeneration haze that you get in Ambazani.
There's so much you could have done with that. And it kind of is, I mean, obviously, I guess they've done it in Castrovolva, but thinking about it, it's like, you know, you have that bit in Androzani where you have the Master sort of saying, oh, no, my dear Doctor, you must die. And you almost sort of think, oh, couldn't this have been some sort of a Master story? Couldn't the Master have done something to make him go mental?
That would have been really cool.
Rather than just, he's mad for the sake of it. And yeah, I don't mind the strangling of Perry, but I think there needed to...
In general, in this story.
I just think that if you were going to do that today, you would have so much more of a repercussion. I think this is the thing, and I guess this, again, going back to Deep Breath, what Deep Breath does well is that it gives you this sense of, the Doctor is a man that has changed so much and he needs Clara's help. And Clara sort of feels like, well, I kind of owe it to him because I, you know, she basically fancied the 11th Doctor.
Yeah.
And you almost want to have that sort of drama of Perry thinking like, I fancied the 5th Doctor. I think there's, you know, she obviously fancied the 5th Doctor.
Well, she even says...
And she says it, doesn't she?
Well, you were nice and you were sweet and all that stuff.
Yeah. And
she, like, there's that line where when she's like, I've got to live with this face.
Yeah.
It's like, if I was Connor, I'd go, cheers.
Thanks a bunch.
What a horrible thing to say.
Yeah. And I think, this is what I think is really, they should have played on that. They should have played on the fact that, gosh, this guy isn't the guy that I liked, but I nearly died. And he basically killed himself to save me. And he is this way because he saved my life, and, you know, I owe it to him. Or, you know, there's drama to be had there, and it just doesn't come across. It just descends into, oh, I don't like what you're wearing. Well, I don't like what you're wearing. Oh, well, I don't like the way you cook those muffins or those rolls in the kitchen. Oh, well, neither do I. It is the married couple, and that just descends into all of season 23.
I know, I mentioned that. I think I
22
in that final in that fake fan in that final scene. I made that mistake last episode as well, I think. In that final scene when Romulus and Remus are on board the TARDIS, and Perry and the 6th Doctor are still arguing with each other, and they're both stood there like, you know, feckless looking.
I know.
And I'll give you this little tidbit, because I felt really uncomfortable watching the Perry 6th Doctor physical violent strangling stuff.
Yeah.
I think just watching it now, it's really unpleasant to watch.
I think what that needed was, there needed to be something else later in the story where the Doctor really stepped up and saved her from something and really sort of, you know, cemented to her that, okay, you are the same man, and that wasn't just...
Because there's nothing until that on the Doctor, whether you like it or not, and they smile at each other, and that's really lovely, but
everything.
Why on earth is she still there?
This is it. You know,
I've got to live with this face. No, you don't.
Yeah.
He's clearly a dreadful person to be around.
I would stick it on the planet of the slugs and the birdmen.
Leave him there. I found it really uncomfortable, but I did get some solace in this. So apparently when Colin and Nicola first met, there was a bit of frostiness between them. Because
Really?
Think Nicola felt a bit pressured. This is just from stuff that I've read on the internet.
Okay.
You know, about being the senior kind of in the role. She's been on the show for longer than Colin.
Yeah.
And I think she felt a little bit of pressure. I think Colin maybe mistook that for being a bit standoffish or okay. a bit whatever. So to lighten the mood during camera rehearsals for the scene where he's hugging her waist.
Yeah.
He bit her ass.
What?
And apparently that broke the tension. I'm sure it was all taken in great, you know. Oh,
I bet you did the dirty old sod.
It's 1984.
I've seen the Colin Baker years. Every time he talks about a female member of the cast, it's like, oh yeah, she was all right.
I mean, we've all seen, what was it, the Air Zone Solution?
Yes.
Where they get their rocks off. And so then apparently Colin and Kevin McNally both decide this is absolutely hilarious what they've done, and they decide to have a bite Nicola Bryant's ass competition through the rest of the production, at least for the rest of that day. You'll all be very happy to report that Nicola Bryant punched Kevin McNally in the face.
Really? That is amazing.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Let's just put that
in. But he's in series 13, isn't he, this year? Oh my God, this is... Oh, we fucked it up.
Oh.
Someone at bloody Daily Whatever is going to listen to this podcast and be like, oh yeah, Kevin McNally, oh, we'll get all this dirt out on him.
Hey, look, it was 1984... Like, if... Oh, God. You've opened up a real can of worms here.
Don't excuse him.
Quick, go to break now. Go, go, go. Can we have a shoe update?
I'm just wearing the same shoes.
The same shoes?
It's the same shoes. I mean, I can...
How have they... Yeah, I think we need to see them. How's the sock situation? Yes, the socks.
I've got Doctor Who socks on today. TARDIS socks.
Brilliant.
Special.
Brilliant. And I mean, everybody loves them. Yeah, people like them, so.
That, yeah.
I'm obviously wrong.
I saw an old college teacher, a friend of mine, a little while ago.
Yeah.
Literally like a couple of days after I got them, and he looked at them and went, oh, those are nice.
Very snazzy.
Yeah, he was like, oh, they're good, aren't they? I was like, oh, cheers.
Great. Well, you know, one of our iTunes reviews was headlined Matt's shoes. Yeah, so that there we go. They've become a law unto themselves. I'm glad that everybody's enjoying them. Should we talk about Mestor and his plot? Because I think that bears some conversation.
Mestor, as a design, as a monster, he looks absolutely horrendous.
He's an owl slug.
Yeah. I just don't know why he's so bad.
But, I know.
You know, and nothing against the guy playing him. I think the guy playing him does a very good job of trying to be a scary monster with what he's got to work with. Unfortunately, that the whole look and appearance just doesn't work. I think the idea of
a slug gastropod.
Yeah.
Very
and, you
cool.
Know, the stuff about getting your feet stuck in the slime.
That was great. That's like a Doctor Who monster thing.
Yeah.
You know, that's cool.
That works really well. Like all that, unfortunately, he doesn't look very good. Plot-wise, his idea to, you know, shift the planets around, blow up the sun and send all these eggs hurling through the universe, I actually don't mind that. I think is as a Doctor Who baddie plot, it's ridiculous and over the top.
Mm-hmm.
Fine. What I will say, though, is the Jocondans, they look really good.
Do you think?
I think they do.
Do you?
I think they look quite interesting.
Okay.
I think, maybe not their outfits, but the makeup, I think, is really good. I like the sort of featheriness and the...
I couldn't quite work out what they're supposed to be. Because
I think they're like birdmen, aren't they?
Yeah. I forget the name of the main one. Drac, is it? There's that weird... When he gets, like, psychically attacked.
Oh, yeah.
And he goes,
oh, yeah, he calls, that's doesn't he?
Calls.
I like that.
I was like, okay, well, they're trying to do something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, they're trying to look into it.
Death by embolism. it's so random.
It is bizarre.
Of all the things.
I know.
Embolism?
Embolism, why not? He is an OP Doctor Who monster.
He really is.
He can fry someone's mind via telekinesis or telepathy or whatever from at least half a mile away.
Yeah.
Why isn't everyone dead?
I know. This is the... Like, on paper, he is like up there with Sutek.
When
you think about it.
Literally.
And like, he's like talking to bloody... Ajmel from across space, you know, he's on that spaceship and he's on Jocondo.
One thing I did find really funny about that is when he was like, I will show you my mental power, and he picks Ajmel to meld minds with. It's like, he's like clearly not very well.
Yeah.
He's a really bad example. Yeah. Like, he's sick. He's been in a rejuvenation chamber the whole episode.
And I guess that's the thing, isn't it, really? Because otherwise you would think, well, hang on, if he can just mind meld with this old git, then why can't he just take over the brain of, know, the twins' dad, and he'd just be like, come on, boys, well, we're going out for a trip to Gioconda.
Or just, like, read their minds
and just get the information.
The formula or the maths or whatever. Originally in the script, apparently, the Giocondans and Mestor and the gastropods are just apparently dropped near the end of part four for no reason whatsoever.
Right.
And it's revealed that there is another creature called Aslan that is actually in control of Mestor, and the Doctor fights him in a different dimension.
What?
And obviously that was cut.
Obviously, I can imagine Eric Saylor just thinking, this story is bad enough as it is. We do not need to add anything else into the mix.
Do you want to know who Mestor is? He's been in Doctor Who before.
Has he really?
Mm. I'll find his name in my list. It's Edwin Richfield.
So the name doesn't really mean anything. He was on Twitter the other day because the Eagle Moss's Mestor figurine came out. And
Edwin Richfield on Twitter?
And he was on there, and he was like, oh, I can't believe a character that I played 30 years ago is now made as a figurine.
Well, he's actually probably more iconic and in Doctor Who fandom liked for playing another character in Doctor Who. You probably won't know, and I wouldn't. I mean, he's under all the latex, and it's not you can hear it in his voice.
No.
He's Captain Hart from the Sea Devils.
Captain Hart?
He's the main captain of the Sea Fort, of the naval base.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's him.
He is Mestor.
The kind of drawn, kind of gauntish looking bloke with, that's him.
Really?
I IMDb says so.
Oh, I think that's wrong.
Apparently it is him. Apparently. Edwin Richfield. Have a quick Google while I tell you a few other
casting
facts.
Tell me some more facts. I need to find out this.
One of the gastropods is Stephen Wickham, who is the Gelf bride in in Polymorph 2 Emo Hawk.
Excellent.
Or Emo Hawk Polymorph 2. And Graham Cole is one of the Gioconda's, who is PC Tony Stamp in The Bill.
Oh, really?
And previously in Doctor Who, do you know the other Doctor Who characters he played? Monsters.
He was Cyberman, wasn't he?
He was Cyberman in Earthshock and the Five Doctors.
Right.
He's also Melka.
Yes, he was Melka, wasn't he?
The Keeper of Trocken and Time Flight. And was also a Marshman in Full Circle.
Oh.
Besides a few other sort of bit parts and other background. There's some...
Good grief, cool.
It's him, yeah. Matt has Googled it.
I just cannot believe that.
It's him. Yeah. Other people would have Googled it. You'll know the character. If you know the Sea Devils, you'll know him.
No, he's died. So who the hell was the guy on?
Is somebody impersonating Edwin Richfield on?
Maybe he just did the voice.
But he was cast for his voice. But I get the impression it's him in the outfit.
In the costume, yeah.
Man.
If anyone knows, this is a...
IMDb said it. We'll put it out there.
I mean,
people
I
know
it
any
up
differently.
On Doctor Who TARDIS Wiki.
Okay.
And they said that. So, I don't know. People on Twitter, let us know.
Because this is
a mystery that I need to be solved.
Now, I mentioned at the beginning, one of the things that I found really frustrating watching this story is that it will introduce something, or two things in particular, that you think, that's actually quite cool.
Yeah.
And then it will immediately bollocks it up. For example... In part two, I think it is, when they're escaping the pod. Is it? No, sorry. Part two's cliffhanger is the thing exploding.
The thing blowing up, yeah.
Perry's in the TARDIS because she's been transmatted there.
Yeah.
And they introduce the idea that he's shifted in time. The Doctor shifted in time. But because his watch is 10 seconds... Or Perry's watch has stopped.
That's right, yeah.
So he was 10 seconds ahead.
Yeah.
So he lands in the TARDIS and... Perry and Lang aren't in there. So theoretically, if it's 10 seconds in the future, they should have been there.
Yeah, that always bugs me.
So it's like, that's a cool idea.
Yeah.
And they immediately bollocks it up.
Yeah.
That was really frustrating.
I thought the same thing when I watched it. I was like, well, surely they ought to be there.
Now, that is a hangover from, I think, the original title was A Stitch in Time.
Right.
There was obviously going to be a lot more playing around with time and all that kind of stuff. But naturally, when we get to the end of the story and they mention bringing the planets in orbit, and the Doctor's like, well, how are you going to do that?
Yeah.
And they mention slipping the two planets into a different time stream.
Yeah.
That's, you know, a cool idea. Doesn't go anywhere.
No.
And it's mentioned in one line of dialogue and nobody ever refers to it again.
Right. Yeah.
Now, the frustrating part about the planets idea, because it kind of put me in mind of playing pool with planets in Red Dwarf.
Yeah.
Very similar to that. And, you know, it's going to get into the gravitational pull of the sun and so on. But that's not actually how orbits work anyway.
Right.
Now, I know this is a nitpicking thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's nothing to do with the size or of the actual object. It's the mass. So it might be that the planets, the smaller planets, might actually be heavier than Gioconda.
Right, yeah.
It's got nothing to do with their size dragging them into the sun. But it's just endemic of this story. It's just every time it does something that you're like, oh, seconds later, you're like, oh.
I think it just goes to show that Eric had enough.
I think so.
You know, it was...
I don't blame him.
It was clearly a very troubled script. I'm shocked, really, that he didn't write the opening story for the Doctor.
Well, he was... So apparently he was angling...
He'd done Resurrection, hadn't he?
Yeah, and year. I think so there's still a thing about you can't be a script editor and actually have a credit.
So he'd had his story for the year.
Tell Paula Moore that, you know, or Ian Levine.
Yeah,
I think that it's fair to say Eric Saward as a writer had his time in the sun with Earthshock, and Resurrection of the Daleks.
Yeah.
Besides that, the tonal inconsistencies, the whiplash from season to season in the 80s, especially, like, okay, one of the things that knit it together are the design. I mean, in this story, obviously not, because it looks crap.
Yeah.
But the music is very spangly, very 80s. It's Malcolm Clarke doing the music.
Malcolm Clarke, I was going to say, I quite like the organ music that he adopts as the Sixth Doctor's theme. Yeah, I like that.
And the callback to Resurrection when he mentions Tegan.
Yeah, that's really the nice. Motif. He brings that back, yeah.
But Eric Saward, you know, as script editor for the show, I mean, he probably fixed a lot of scripts.
Yeah.
But I'd really love to know how much of this he wrote or rewrote or whatever.
The only redeemable feature is Colin and Nicola, to be fair. I think
Nicola's doing
job.
Everything she possibly can to kind of stabilize Perry's position in the story, because she could have played it like, I really don't want to be here, because that you look at the dialogue and you think that could be played as I'm done by the end of this story, and I'm going to leave you and the TARDIS and blah, 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 which she probably ought to have done given the way that the Sixth Doctor treated her. There's nothing redeemable about their relationship in that story. But then this is the thing that I found with that final scene in the TARDIS, is there's a glimmer of hope in there.
Yeah.
And we know that they're great. And their chemistry on screen, even when the unpleasant stuff is happening, is very good.
Yes.
But beyond that final scene, there is absolutely nothing in this story that if I was on floor 6 at Television Centre in the BBC and I watched that, there is nothing in this that would give me hope to think, yeah, we should keep this running.
I know, this is the problem.
You look at it and you just think it's passé. It's just it's such a, why are we wasting our money on this?
Mm.
I wouldn't be surprised if that was the story they looked at and went, we're still making this?
Yeah.
This is like what it was when I was 20 years younger. It's not moved on. Well, literally. It's such a shame, especially placed where it is in the history of the show, what was going on with the production behind the scenes, and obviously what happens with Colin's dismissal and all of that stuff. But as part of this kind of relaunch of the Review of Death, the point is we'll find things in these stories that are generally considered to be not very good, and this is not a very good story, obviously. We'll find things to like in them.
Yeah.
And so my thing would obviously be Colin.
It's just Colin, isn't it? Yeah.
He's brilliant in it.
Yeah.
And he's the only thing in it that you could class as brilliant.
Yeah. I think really. That's it, isn't it? Even when he's being unlikable, you know, and you're like, oh God, I really don't like this Doctor. You know, even then, he is the thing that your eyes are drawn to. And no, not because
not
of the
just
code,
because of the outfit.
It's just because of his acting, you know. It's just he's giving it his all. And I think, when you get to the end, in that final confrontation with him and Mestor, he does a really good job. He really sells it. You know, you really do think, oh yeah, I can see his Doctor here.
Exactly.
You know. And it's just a shame that he's just had 3 episodes of all this baggage. yeah, it's and then the worst thing is to think that JNT was like, oh yeah, we want this story to be the story that makes people want to come back. I'm worried that people won't come back and watch it, you know, and this was the story. And it's like, my God, if that is the, like, the death knell for the program, I don't know what is.
It's the last episode of the season.
Yeah.
There's a 9-month gap now,
yeah,
until Attack of the Cybermen.
Yeah.
This is not an advert,
no,
to suggest you should come back and carry on watching,
yeah,
the show. It's absolutely... Russell T. Davis said it in SFX. This is the beginning of the end of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
This story.
Yeah, it is.
It is.
Yeah.
You know, people will say, well, Sylvester was the Doctor when it ended, so he must be responsible for it being cancelled. Mm. This is a show that has completely run out of ideas.
Yeah.
JNT absolutely should have left at this point.
Yeah.
Because nothing that comes from him, in my opinion, obviously we don't know full creative license on who,
yeah,
puts what in and who kind of, you know, blah, blah, blah. They've run out of ideas.
Yeah.
It's just treading water. And you get, your first Doctor's script is written by somebody who has never written for Doctor Who before.
Yeah.
Fine. People have come into the show and never written for the show before, never even written sci-fi before, and they've,
yeah,
excelled. But he hasn't even written anything original, apparently. He's,
yeah,
only written adaptations of classical literature and drama. Yeah. And it really shows.
It shows.
It's paralyzingly strange that this is what they put out. And,
yeah,
thought they'd get away with it, or what?
Yeah.
Like, what were they thinking?
I mean, this is the thing, like, you know, in hindsight, you're like, oh, you know, they should have given it to a safe pair of hands, like Bob Holmes. But of course, we know that JNT was very adamantly against using old writers for whatever reason, you know, and especially after Bob Holmes had just written a bloody brilliant story.
Right.
You think, oh, crikey, get Terrence Dix on the phone. He knows how to introduce a doctor. Look at Robot.
I have to say, I think that there is, I mean, that argument comes up now.
Yeah.
But I think there is, of course, that thing when you go, well, look, if Uncle Terrence was still alive, you know, you couldn't get him to write a 45-minute or 50-minute episode of Jodie series.
Oh, no, not at all.
It wouldn't work. And I thoroughly believe that. I think Bob Holmes is a great outlier.
Yeah.
In that he kept coming back through the show through many different iterations, whoever was producing it. And, you know, with the exception of, like, the Crotons.
Yeah.
Always pulled in at least a half-decent script.
Oh, yeah.
If not all great.
I think that's it, you know.
To a degree.
The stories like The Sunmakers, it's let down as a production, not because of the script and not because of the actors, but because of the way it looks, you know. There's no money there and it just looks bad. And I mean, we'll get to that, I'm sure, at some point.
At some point. And I was really surprised when I was doing my notes ahead of our recording for Underworld that it's Bob Baker and Dave Martin.
Yeah.
I'd completely forgotten they'd written that story.
I'd forgotten that as well.
And it's like, they all have duds.
Yeah.
They all have duds. Are you hiring Anthony Stephen because he can turn a script round quickly?
Yeah.
Well, he can't.
No.
Are you hiring Anthony Stephen because he's got a pedigree for writing drama?
Yeah.
And you want this Doctor to be, you know, big and dramatic and showman-y and, you know, really theatrical and blah, blah, blah. Fine. But that might come across in the script, and Colin does a good job with it.
Yeah.
But you actually have to have a story there as well. And, you know, what we said about the direction, I think it's fair to say it's really rudderless and flat. The design is not very good. But it's the script that sinks it.
That is the problem. And I think, you know, when you think of something like, say, Attack of the Cybermen, you think that would have been... I mean, Attack of the Cybermen is an okay story.
I don't mind it at all.
It's just, you know, it's just an average run-of-the-mill...
And it's that kind of cathartic Sayward grimness.
Yeah.
That, you know, is all right in bits and bobs, but that's the tonal whiplash I was talking about earlier. Like,
and you sort of think, oh, you know, if Attack of the Cybermen had been the introductory story for that Doctor, it would have worked so much better. Because, you know, you could have had your Doctor being a bit doolally or whatever, but you would have the security of, well, we've got a very successful monster, especially Cybermen at that point were massive. So it does just baffle me to think, why would you commission someone like that? But then again, they do it in the following season. They get someone like Glenn McCoy to write Time Lash.
They just didn't learn their lesson.
And that is just appalling. But Eric Sayward always said, he said, it is very difficult to find people who knew how to write for Doctor Who. And it's evident in these couple of seasons in particular. And to be honest, I don't really think that most of Peter Davison's stuff, story-wise, is that good. Me and Johnny,
I agree. Me and Johnny
were talking about if we were talking about possible collection sets in the future, and we said, "Oh, season 20 is the one that keeps getting mentioned," and I said, "Oh God," I said, "I'm kind of dreading that season." I said, because none of the stories in that season are particularly good. They're just sort of like, "Oh, that's all right. Arc of Infinity, it's okay. Mordred Undead, it's okay. Snake Dance, it's okay."
I quite like Terminus.
Terminus is quite good. Enlightenment
is fine.
Is fine.
It's quite cerebral. It's, you know.
I mean, sometimes it puts me to sleep.
Well, yeah.
King's Demons is just mad. And it's just like, yeah, there's just really, there's nothing there. There's no, and especially after like season 19, which has got such a real, massive burst of energy until you get to something like Time Flight. And then it's like, do we trace it back to Time Flight? Is that where it starts going a bit, oh, it's all going a bit wrong here?
I think it will be really, I'm really looking forward to doing more Eric Saywood stories.
Yeah.
Because part of me thinks, look, play the game. I know that you don't really like the stuff that you're working on and that you think you can make it better, but try and make it better.
Yeah.
But because then you get to, Attack of the Cybermen. And it's like, this is the story, the kind of Doctor Who that Eric Saywood thinks it should be.
Yeah.
Same with Earthshock, you know, same with Resurrection of the Daleks. But it's so morose.
Mm.
And even so, when you get a story that, you know, and he's, you know, they always say like, oh, he's the prodigy of like, Rob Holmes, or, you know, he was more of like an apprentice character or whatever.
It's just, part of me just feels like, just play the game. Mm. Like you're not going to get your way.
Yeah.
Stop. Cause you're actually damaging the show's continuity in terms of mood and stuff like that. By just suddenly shifting to, we're going to have a story where, you know, Lytton gets his hands crushed by Cybermen. Comparing that to this,
yes.
Okay, it might be somebody else's cup of tea, but it's not consistent. No. And for me, you know, the 80s, the whole tenure, until you get to Sylve, when things start to stabilise, because you've got, you know, Andrew Cartmell in, and he's not really fighting JNT.
I think by that point, JNT is just...
Oh, he's checked out anyway.
Yeah. I'm just, you know... Let me sort out the casting, darling, and sort the money out. Leave it with me.
I'll get Nick Parsons on the phone.
Yeah, you know, we'll get some good people in.
But that's because 80s Doctor Who, I've realised, is so not my cup of tea. Until you get to Sylve. And I think it's because it's just, not just in terms of quality, but in terms of mood. And it's just all over the place.
Yeah.
It's just one week, you've got Earthshock, which is one of my favourite Doctor Who stories of all time. And then you get a Time Flight, or you get an Arc of Infinity, and it's just tonal whiplash.
Yeah.
And Doctor Who needs somebody steering it in one direction, really. You know, they need to have a clear idea of what they're doing. Who do you lay the blame with in that situation? I don't know. Is it Eric Saywood for not relenting and going, let's just play the game and let's just make a decent show with what we've got?
Yeah.
Because he's tried to do that with this story. Fine, it hasn't paid off, but it's a dreadful script to start with. Do you just keep fighting against your producer and say, no, this is what we should be doing? And then have a massive falling out.
Yeah.
And then, you know, obviously scar people for a long time with the way that production worked out and the bad blood that was there. People never got over that. They still haven't got over what was going on back in those days. And, you know, not just talking about the production, but, you know, other stuff that has sort of come to light and so on. And that's not our place to talk about here. But it is the beginning of the end for the show, this story. And I think by that metric, you can't not say it's the worst story of all time.
Yeah, see, I was going to... When you said that, you know, it's like, oh, no, there must be something worse than this. And I'm trying to think...
Maybe don't contextualise it as the start of it. But I think you can't ignore it.
I don't think you can. I don't think you can. I mean, and I think they're probably... I think then in this respect, I probably... I'm still thinking, would I kind of want to watch this more than some other stories? And yeah, possibly. You know, I would maybe rather watch this than say...
In the Forest of the Night.
Yeah, or something else from that era. I'm trying to think. Oh, God, that bloody... a Shilder story Rufus Hound in it. That's appalling.
But at least that's got, like, production value.
At least that's only 45 minutes.
Exactly. I wrote that at the start. I was like, this format doesn't work.
No.
Four-part stories do not work anymore. Thank God they did the 45-minute thing the next year, or later in the year with the next season. Maybe I'm being too harsh on it. You know, it's a piece of work at the end of the day. Lots of people put a lot of effort into
it. This is the funny thing, isn't it?
It's just look at it in the context of what's come before and what's coming afterwards. And it feels like a central pivot point where the show goes from actually trying something different and producing really great stuff like Caves of Androzani to this being the... Every Doctor Who parody is based off of this story.
Yeah.
The Perry even makes a reference of all these corridors look the same.
Yeah.
Mestor and his death, Ricky Gervais takes the nick out of in extras some, you know, 20 years later or whatever.
The Doctor's costume is parodied in
Lenny Henry, everyone.
Fredrik Saunders, all that
stuff. It's his jacket with Tom's scarf.
Yeah.
Everybody parodies.
Yeah.
The design of it.
Yeah.
It just becomes the stick to beat Doctor Who with.
Yeah. And it's also brightly lit as well. I mean, save for those bits in, like, the corridors in episode 2 where you've got that sort of chiaroscuro lighting going on through the vents and stuff, which is like, wow, this looks really good. Why does the rest of it look like primetime Saturday night game show TV?
It's so brightly lit.
Yeah, like...
So brightly lit.
I completely forgot about, like, the police station, which is, like, 1970s-esque, like, wood panels.
It's bloody UFO.
I know, it looks ridiculous.
It's Space 1999.
And
Dennis Cherry doesn't turn up again. There's no... And they mentioned the mum.
Yeah.
She's off-screen and they all hate her.
Yeah.
Even Dennis Cherry is like, I know your mum's a bit of a, you know,
so bit of a lag,
but you've got to get on with her because she's your mum. Just because she's biologically related to us doesn't mean we have to show her affection.
Yeah.
That just because this show is biologically attached to my favourite programme of all time does not mean that I can't say it's the worst Doctor Who system. It's just awful.
I think that's a good end line there.
Yeah. I was quite proud of that. But does it get any better in a fortnight's time?
So, yes, of course. So you voted...
It has to. It has to.
So you voted for Underworld as our next story.
Which I mean, can I just say as well, and maybe I need to reword it, but everybody's saying, we've got to get them to review Time Flight. You can rig the vote if you want, but that means you have to vote for either one of the other two.
Yeah.
Because Time Flight was getting lots of votes.
Yeah.
So... Just to say, maybe I'll reword it. Or something. I think I'll reword it. But for this one and for the Time Flight vote, it was the least bad one.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to just go for which one do you think is the worst. So I didn't really want to say that because it was really incendiary.
It does, yeah. I'm actually quite looking forward to watching it.
Me too.
Because it's one of those stories where I always forget what is really going on in the plot. It's one of those stories that I just sort of switch off and I'm doing other things and then, oh, it's the end. Good. On to the next story, whatever that is.
A bit like you said this
one. A bit like this one.
Same sort of thing.
And
but it's got your favourite Doctor.
It's got my favourite Doctor in. You know, it's, like I said, it's Bob Baker and Dave Martin, good writers. Leela, very good. K-9, very good. You know, it's... There should be something good to come out of this, surely.
Other than
shocking colour separation overlay.
Well, we've got that and much more to explore in a fortnight's time.
Yeah.
So not next Monday, but the Monday afterwards, you'll see... I mean, that's completely irrelevant if you're watching this like a year ahead or whatever. But yeah, the next episode of the Review of Death podcast, or the Review of Death, a Doctor Who podcast, is Underworld.
Yeah.
With Tom Baker, Louise Jameson, and John Leeson.
Yes.
Which is very exciting.
Yeah. Sorry.
I'm just speaking just because I need to get the taste out of Twitter.
Thank you very much for listening or watching, and we'll see you again next time. Bye-bye.